Hey everyone, this is Aman here from the future. I just wanted to mention that Games Workshop sent us this Warcry box for free so that we could talk about the Warcry Heart of Ghur box set. I hope you enjoy the episode. Welcome back to Path to Glory, the Warhammer Underworlds podcast that focuses on competitive gaming, player development, and community growth. In this episode, we won't be talking about Warhammer Underworlds. I know, crazy. But instead, we've got a super cool episode lined up for you today where we're going to be talking about Warcry, specifically the new box set, The Heart of Ghur. But before we do that, we just want to thank our patrons, so thanks to everyone who supports us. You literally help keep the lights on. If you're interested in supporting the podcast monetarily, please check us out at patreon.com/pathtoglory. And if that's not possible, that's totally okay. We still appreciate the listens and the ratings. I'm your host, Aman Kusro, and I'm joined by my co-host, Zach Kushetta, a.k.a. Requizen. How's it going, brother?
Pretty good. How about yourself?
Doing all right. Just trying to power through this Texas heat.
Yeah, it's pretty crazy down by you guys, huh?
Yeah, it's 104 Fahrenheit.
104 at 10 o'clock at night?
Well, no, that's not true. It's 90 at night. But
Yeah. So much more livable.
But for our Celsius folk, that's 40 degrees Celsius. That's
yeah.
Pretty hot. And 90 would be 32 at night. So,
yeah.
Yep. So, anywho, yeah, how about you?
Pretty good, you know, just going on vacation tomorrow and talking about in 2 days and talking about Warcry today. So, that's good stuff, man. I'm excited.
Yeah, where are you going for vacation?
We're going to a wedding in Colorado. So, Colorado. Just going to visit some family and, yeah, it'll be good.
You know, I hate flying in and out of Colorado because it's like surrounded by mountains, so the turbulence gets really wild.
It does, yeah.
For no reason. But, alas, can't complain too much. First world problems.
True.
Okay, so we've got a pretty jam-packed episode, so we're not going to keep everyone waiting. I guess I just wanted to start with, you know, our backgrounds with Warcry, how familiar we are with it. I know that, Zach, you're a very avid Warcry player. What is your experience with Warcry?
Yeah, I've been playing Warcry since the beginning. I kind of picked it up when it first came out. In my area, it was pretty popular. A lot of our Age of Sigmar players and Underworlds players tried it out, really liked it. It was a nice casual game, you know, between big AOS tournaments and cutthroat Underworlds games. It was nice to kind of have this more casual, fun game that really quick matches, you know, not too brain drainy. And we all really got into it. Before we got to do any events, we had a lockdown and pandemic and stuff. So we didn't really get to explore the, kind of the full depths of it. But then I kept up with it through COVID. I've kind of bought almost everything except Red Harvest. I've been keeping up with publications. I even did a Warcry battle report for my YouTube channel. This was, I think, like almost a year ago now. But I think it's a really fun game. I think it's a really nice casual game. It's one that I like to teach people because it's really easy to teach and pick up and play and, you know, show non-war gamers or like returning war gamers or even just war gamers who want like a small, quick skirmish type game.
Yeah, I think that's kind of where the appeal lies for me. So for me, it sounds like you got a lot more into it than I did. I started with the original core set, like first edition Warcry, whatever. But I kind of fell off very quickly. I think I bought the it's the warband with like the snakes and the elf.
That's Splintered Fang, yeah.
The Splintered Fang, correct. And then after that, I didn't play too much. But then when the second edition, I think it was like Catacombs,
mm-hmm.
if that is second edition.
Well, Catacombs was kind of like a alternate game mode. But yeah, it was the first big expansion that came out. Yeah.
Well, so I think one of the biggest things that drew me to Warcry to begin with was the miniatures are fantastic.
Mm.
They have some of the coolest miniatures, like the different spins on chaos, how, you know, all these humans, these like, literal peasants in some cases, like don't even understand what chaos is, and they are worshipping chaos in different ways, or maybe, you know, they're just like some tribal indigenous people who, you know, like believe that they're the swamp that they live in, or, you know, this statue is needs to be worshipped, and it inadvertently leads them down the path to damnation, right?
Mm-hmm.
The, I guess, suppose a path to glory, if you will, as a little self-plug. So that's what I thought was the coolest part. The character, very similar to Underworlds, where it just evokes a lot of uniqueness. And I always wondered why there wasn't so much synergy between Warcry and Underworlds, and I get that Underworlds warbands can be played in Warcry. As you mentioned in the pre-show, they're called Bladeborn. But I definitely think Warcry warbands should be made for Warhammer Underworlds. And we'll, and it's really simple, I think, without, you know, going down too rabbit hole. Like, every warband has fighters that like are mono, like not monopose, but can only be built with certain loadouts. Right? Like, the leader has a certain loadout.
Yeah, there's a couple per warband. Usually there's like a one weapon option, or, you know, like you can have a spear or a sword, but most of them are just like it's a dude with a shield and a spear, or like it's a dude with two clubs or something like that.
Exactly. And so like the thing is with, like, you know, with Underworlds we talk about range and the names of weapons, but you can just call them like, you know, weapons of whatever, and then it doesn't matter. So what I'm saying is this, to be succinct. If there are fighters with only one weapon option available, then, you know, build their fighter cards around that one weapon option. If there are fighters that can be built with multiple weapon options, then it doesn't matter. Just give them, like, a generic weapon name. And then whether you build him with a spear, you know, like the elf from the Splintered Fang, you can give him two swords, or, like, I think a whip and a sword, or a spear and a sword.
Yeah, I think, yeah, something like that.
So it doesn't matter which one you pick, because it'll just say, like,
venomous weapons.
Venomous weapons, you know, yeah, exactly. And that's it. And then you can, and I think that would help Underworlds grow tremendously.
I have seen some people do that with, there's a couple custom warband channels across the various Discords. Mm-hmm. I think some people have done that with, like, Iron Golems or, like, Untamed Beasts and tried that out. So, yeah. I mean, I definitely encourage people to, you know, seek these out and try some custom ones. And yeah, GW, if you're listening, you know, good way for people to use their models, good way for you to get people playing the various games. I agree. I think it'd be pretty fun.
Yeah. And, like, you know, we call these skirmish games, jokingly among us, like gateway games, right?
Mm-hmm.
And the best way to get people to get deeper into the hobby and eventually upgrade to those larger games is cross-pollinate the smaller games.
Mm-hmm.
So I think that could be really interesting. But going back to my experience with the Warcry, I fell in love with the Scions of the Flame.
Hmm.
That is the coolest looking warband to me by far.
You like the samurai look?
Exactly. I love Japanese samurai. Like, I played Ghost of Tsushima twice. Like, super fun experience. And you combine, like, some of the coolest things. Fire, chaos, and samurai aesthetic.
Mm-hmm.
And it's like, what more do you want? You know?
Yeah, I think they're probably one of my favorites as well. I like them. I like the Cypher Lords. I really like the Unmade, but I'm, like, really scared to paint them because there's so many little details on them. Those are the ones who wear, like, they, like, take their faces off and put them on their belts and stuff like that. It's crazy. And
yeah.
I'm very intimidated by those models, even though I've owned them for, like, 2 years now.
Yeah, they're wilding out, for sure. Like, I think I really like the Corvus Cabal. Like, it's not my aesthetic, if you will,
mm-hmm.
but I like what I've seen people do with them, which I think is really cool.
I have seen people paint the I can't remember the name of him. I think he's like the Talon, the dude, the big dude with the wings. I've seen them paint him as a chicken or, like, you know, various birds, and everyone has some creative thing to do with them. So yeah, there's definitely a lot of room. Even though they're monopose models, even though there's, like, you know, the Splintered Fang are always dudes with snakes, you know, the Cypher Lords are always dudes in robes, like, even though that's kind of standard, people have put a lot of character and, you know, their own personalization on these models, and I think that's awesome.
Yeah, I think the propensity to for them to look really cool, whether you keep the original sculpt or you convert it, if you will, I think there's some of the most striking, beautiful miniatures out there, and that's coming from an Underworlds player, right?
Yeah.
And I think we're spoiled for choice.
You know, people talk about the big models in AOS, like the foxes for Lumineth, or like some of the big chaos demons. But man, the skirmish games, like in terms of model quality, you just can't beat it.
Yeah, even kill teams got some bangers. Mm-hmm. So, but anyways, we digress, right? So, Warcry for me has always been a game where it's the term I've been heard was when I first learned about the game was it's beer and pretzels.
Mm-hmm.
Whether you agree with that term or that line of thinking or not, to me, I agree with you that it does feel very casual. And I think what drew me away from it ultimately was the fact that, like, it wasn't as competitive as Underworlds. But I think when you're super competitive, you probably only have room for one game. And so I might start revisiting this game again as more of a palate cleanser.
Yeah, and I think that's definitely a way to think about it. This is not, at least for me, it's a little bit like, you know, other casual games where it can't be the only game I play because I would get bored of it. Because, like, the depth, there is some depth there, but not as much as Underworlds or Kill Team. So it can't be the only game I play because I would, you know, get bored or burn out of it. But yeah. Like, hey, I just did an Underworlds event. Now I'm just going to, and I don't have anything else to practice for a while. Let's just play Warcry for a while. Let's just roll dice. Let's just have a good time. And then you get back into Age of Sigmar or Underworlds or, you know, whatever your poison is, Kill Team or Marvel, whatever you're playing. But yeah, for me, this is kind of like I'm going down to the game store. I don't have any events to prepare for. I want to get in three games in a single night with various people in my club. Warcry is a great pick.
Yeah, I think so. And I think it's a great entry-level game as well, right?
Yes.
And we'll talk about that. So why don't we just get into the rules, right? So the idea of this episode is, you know, again, we're an Underworlds podcast, right? And we have covered Kill Team content in the past. But the idea is always to tint through the lens of an Underworlds player because most of our, I would say 95% of our listeners play Underworlds or have an interest in Underworlds. Mm-hmm. And so the idea is, while we don't want you to stop playing Underworlds, what we want you to do is check out these other games because they're awesome. And there's something here for everyone. And that's the same thing that we do with these Kill Team episodes, right? So for Warcry today, the idea is that Zach and I are going to just run through how to play a game of Warcry, talk about some of the rules. Zach is going to share what rules that he found were different from the last edition. And then we're just going to talk about the new warbands, maybe give our thoughts on that. And then we're going to touch on narrative play and match play as well. So 13 minutes in, I'm kind of giving you a summary. But if you're an avid listener of the podcast, which many of you are, then you'll know that we tend to go down a lot of rabbit holes. And so
we'll try to keep it succinct.
Yeah. So why don't we start with how are we going to play a game of Warcry? So Zach, let's say you have someone come into the store and they're like looking for their little gateway into the hobby, and you're like, hey, let's play Warcry. How would you explain it to them in layman's terms?
Yeah. Warcry is a really simple game because everything's kind of explained to you as the game goes on. Because when you go to set up, all you need is your lists. Each player needs 1,000 points, luckily for you, and from Games Workshop. Every one of the Warcry warbands is around 1,000 points. So if you buy the new Heart of Gurbox, you're going to get about 1,000 points of Horns of Hashut. You're going to get about 1,000 points of, I'm blanking on the name, the Rottmire Creed. And you'll be ready to go. If you're coming in with Age of Sigmar stuff, you'll have to build a list, but we could talk about that later. Basically, you draw, there's four decks of cards you're going to draw from. There's the terrain card, which will show you how to set up the battlefield. The terrain cards come with the boxes, so there will be a terrain card with Heart of Gur, but if you have one of the older boxes, you'll have terrain cards for that terrain in particular. Then you draw a deployment card. This will tell you how to set up your models. You'll draw victory condition card, which will tell you what you're trying to do, whether you're holding objectives, picking up treasure, killing specific models or just trying to be in specific places like King of the Hill. And then you draw a twist card, and the twist card is add something spicy to the game. Maybe random monsters spawn. Maybe everybody's a little bit faster or a little bit slower. Maybe you get extra ability dice. But it's like one little thing, so every game feels a little different. You know, if you, you know, even if you only take the victory and twist cards into account, there's dozens and dozens of different combinations that you could end up with, and a lot of different ways that you can end up playing the game. And then from there, you just kind of go back and forth. Warcry is an alternating activation game. You'll just go back and forth selecting a model. Each model takes two actions, and we'll talk about the actions in a bit. And then you just go back and forth till you run out of models, and then you start the next round. And that's basically about it. Actions and reactions are kind of the next big thing to talk about. But in terms of playing the game, it's just set up the board, see the victory conditions, and then alternate activating models until the game's over. And the mission card will tell you when the game's over, usually around three or four, or until a specific model is dead. So, yeah, I mean, it's a really quick and easy game. And everyone I've taught, be they wargamers or, you know, non-wargamers, they've all picked it up by the end of round one and haven't had anything explained to them. So, yeah.
I think that was a really good summary, and I think it just explains how like easy it is to grasp the game if you're just paying a little bit of attention. And I think some of the favorite games I have from Games Workshop in general are alternating activation games. Underworld's Kill Team, you know, have that ability to always keep it engaging, and you know, being able to have fun with one another, but not wait for someone to move their entire army or etc. is quite pleasant. And you get that feeling here with Warcry, you know, the idea of two lightly outfitted and smaller groups of warbands just, you know, slashing into each other is pretty tight. And so there are a lot of warbands that players can play from. There are quote-unquote warbands that are created specifically for Warcry, but then can be, you know, later applied to AOS, you know, through, I believe, the Warriors of Chaos.
Yeah, they're Slaves to Darkness in Age of
Sigmar. Slaves to Darkness. That's right. But if you have any other miniatures from other, you know, let's say you play Age of Sigmar and you listen to this, or you even have a Underworlds warband, and you're like, I'll just try Warcry. There are rules for that. And so you can build your own armies with the miniatures that you have. You can convert them and also play with your Underworlds model. So it's pretty tight. And there are just a couple stipulations. I think, like, every, I guess, warband must have, like, the leader, right? Which is similar to Underworlds and Kill Team.
Yeah, so every faction or every warband needs one leader, at least three models, and up to 15 models. You can have up to three leader or hero units in your army. The way it delineates heroes is it uses a rune mark system, so there's little icons on each of your cards that'll tell you what each thing is or what it does or what abilities has access to. The leader one is unique and in that it denotes like who your bosses are. You can have up to three. One of them has to be like your, you know, your leader, your general, your clan leader or something like that. But then, yeah, after that, it's pretty freeform. You know, there's no like, if you're coming from Age of Sigmar or 40K, there's no battle line or troops. There's no like heavy support options. Mm-hmm. It's just take 3 to 15 models, whichever ones you think look cool or you think are going to be fun to put on the table, and go nuts.
Yeah. And it's really cool because like every time you draw those cards to see deployment and the battle plans and etc., you know, like one player you just roll off and one player is the attacker, one player is the defender, and then you set up according to what those positions are. And then oftentimes you'll have to divide your warband into battle groups. So battle groups are essentially small groups of fighters that are set up together at the start of the battle. And each warband is divided into three battle groups: the dagger, the shield, and the hammer. So the defender divides their warband into Gretel boops first, and then the attacker, right? And then you follow the instructions on, you know, where those fighters are placed or deployed when they enter. And that's again what you said earlier, is every game feels different because no two games will ever be alike, and if they ever do, it's few and far between.
Yeah, and because you split these models up and the deployment kind of puts them in different places, maybe your hammer's in the middle of the board and your dagger's like on the edge of the board, you know, it's going to feel dynamic because you might put your strongest, all your strongest models in one detachment, and then they get like shoved off to the side of the board and you can't use them because, you know, you went two all eggs in one basket. And so it kind of encourages you to mix and match your models and not to kind of like, you know, a lot of times in Age of Sigmar or 40K, there's this feeling where you're like, oh, I'm just going to dump all my points into one unit and everything else is just going to kind of be like useless chaff. And you can't really do that here because then it's like, all right, well, what if your one models, your one big, powerful, important model stays off the table for half the game? You know, because there is a reserve system where some stuff stays off and then later on comes onto the table. So you do have to think about it and you do kind of have to like build a nice balanced list that can take on multiple threats.
Yeah, well said, well said. And again, once you get that together, right, super simple, like Zach mentioned earlier, you set up terrain, and then you can either follow a card or, you know, if you don't want to follow a card, you have the ability to do so. You know, players can set up the buildings or the terrain together. Mm-hmm. You can use terrain from multiple sets and combine them into this massive conglomeration of stuff. And then you can just have fun with it. Obviously, there's match play, which we'll get into, but the overall average game of Warcry... is like your imagination is the limit. And then from there you deploy, and then you look at your victory conditions, the twist setup, and then you start fighting the battle. And so Zach, when we start fighting the battle, how do we start doing that?
So there's two main steps for fighting the battle, or three main steps. There's the initiative phase, the reserve phase, and the combat phase. The initiative phase is, I think, the most unique part of Warcry. It's kind of the big thing that sets it apart from other skirmish games. What you do is each player rolls six dice, just D6s. Everything in Warcry is D6s. You roll six dice, and then you make note of matching icons on the dice. So if you have two threes, that's a double. If you have three fives, that's a triple. So they use double, triple, and quad for matching faces. And then whoever has the most singles left over that don't have matches has the initiative. But those matching faces are used for abilities, which are powerful things that fighters can do outside of their normal actions. So you have this really interesting counterplay between, oh, I got a bunch of singles, I have the initiative, I get to decide what goes on, like, or at least how the game starts, which can be really mm-hmm. useful as the game goes on. You know, going first in a turn is always really useful. But also, if you have more doubles and triples and ability dice, then you're going to be able to do cool and crazy things during the game, even if your opponent kind of gets to dictate the early flow of the game. So you finish this initiative phase by kind of, there's also wild dice where every turn a player gets a dice that they can add to one of their pools and, like, you know, turn a double into a triple or add singles to gain more initiative. But once you finish that, you move into the reserve phase, where any models that are off the table come on at their appropriated time, usually turn two or turn three. And then you just go right into the combat phase. And like we said, that goes right through. We go back and forth alternating models. Then we can talk a little bit about how activations and actions work.
Yeah. Yeah, I think that was a great overview. And activations are super simple. So essentially, when a player activates a fighter, that fighter makes two actions chosen from a list of actions that are listed in the core rules. And then the player carries out the first action before deciding the second, of course. And a fighter can make the same action twice in a row. For example, a fighter can attack, or move and then attack, right? And so the different actions at base are move, attack, disengage, and wait. Now, in some examples, and there's a new mechanic that's added, and actually, Zach, mm-hmm. What do you think about the new reaction rule? And why don't you explain what it is and then your thoughts on it?
Right. So you keep track of which fighters have activated as it goes on, right? Like, you'll put a little marker next to a fighter that is mm-hmm. activated. If a fighter has not activated, every warband has a reaction available to them, and then, or well, every warband has a faction reaction, and then there's also three universal reactions that every warband gets access to. So every fighter will have between three and four, depending on their rune marks. And what a reaction does is say, you can use one of your actions now to react to this thing that's happening to you, but you give it up later. So if you react to something that's happening now, say somebody's attacking you and you use counter, then you don't get that action in the next time you activate that fighter. So you'll go from two actions to one action. So rather than, you know, you have to decide, okay, do I want this fighter to move attack or attack, attack, or move, move? Or do I want to react now and then later only attack or later only move because I can't do two things anymore? And I think reactions are a really great addition to the game. For those of you who are kind of coming into it new, maybe you're just an Age of Sigmar player or an Underworlds player, reactions are brand new to this version of Warcry from the previous editions. And I think it does add some depth because now you're not just, all right, my opponent's doing things, I'm going to decide on my next action. Now it's, all right, I have to kind of think forward. Do I want to do this thing that might be weaker than my actual attack or weaker than my actual movement, but could give me a bonus right now, could deal some damage to my opponent, could give me, you know, do a debuff to them. And it does kind of make the action economy feel less solved, because there was kind of a feeling before where, oh, I kind of know how the turn's going to play out. I'm going to do this with this fighter. He's going to do that with that fighter. And as long as I don't die, I'm going to do this with this fighter. Now you kind of don't know how many actions you're going to have if you're going to make these reactions. So I think it's a great addition to the game just from a complexity standpoint. And we can kind of go over the reactions that are in the game. Baseline, we have three. There is, and one of these was shown off on Warhammer Community, but we'll go over them anyway. First, we've got counter. When you're targeted by a melee attack action, so an attack with 3 inches or less range, before they make the dice roll, you say that you're going to counter. And then for any hit roll that misses, the attacker takes 1 damage, and for any hit roll of 1, and 1s are always misses, they take 2 damage. So if somebody comes up with you to you with a lot of attacks, say, you know, there's a lot of beasts that have a lot of attacks, like spiders in these tarantula brood, they run up and they roll a bunch of 1s at you, they can just end up taking 4, 6, 8 damage back. But the downside of this, of course, is that this is lower damage than your attack is probably going to be. So like, you have to decide, do I want to do this counter now and, you know, kind of get this immediate damage on something before anything else happens, or do I want to save that action and then punch back in my activation, just make my regular attack back? And I think there will be situations where you want to do both. Then we've got take cover, which is when you're targeted by a missile attack action, which is a ranged attack action, range 4 or higher. You get to roll a dice for every critical hit the opponent scores, and on a 4+, that critical hit becomes a regular hit instead, which is very big because most range attacks are like damage 1-3, damage 1-4, maybe damage 2-4. And knocking down that critical damage to regular damage is a big deal.
And to clarify very quickly before continue, every attack in Warcry has 2 damage characteristics. One, well, not every, but most, I would say. Mm-hmm. And one, when you roll a regular hit, then it means that it deals the lesser of the two, or the first number in the split. When you roll a critical hit, which is when a fighter rolls a 6 to hit, they do extra damage. So, for example, there's a flamethrower in the Horns of Hashut. And if you do a regular hit with him, he only does 1 damage. But every time you roll a 6, he deals 5 damage. So pretty big deal for some fighters. For other fighters, it's not so much of a big deal.
Yeah, like your little small fighters are usually damage 1-3, and some of them are even damage 1-2. So, you know, there's not a huge difference between a hit and a crit. And then you have, like, spears are damage 1-4 on a lot of mooks. Or, like, on big fighters, you might have damage, like, damage 3-6 on a big beefy fighter. So getting that crit is a huge boost. And take cover can mitigate that somewhat, especially since range attacks can be difficult to deal with. There's a lot of warbands that don't have range attacks or are very slow. So this kind of gives you that option to be like, okay, I'm going to sacrifice one of my actions, but I'm going to mitigate some of this damage that's coming into me as I cross the battlefield.
Yeah.
And then finally, we have strike them down. A fighter can make this reaction when a visible enemy fighter makes a disengage action. So a disengage action is when you start a move within 1 inch of a enemy fighter, you have to disengage and make, instead of making a regular move, it's kind of your, you know, fallback type of action. You don't get your full range of movement. And it's kind of to, it's kind of to denote like a person backing away while still guarding themselves. They're not just running away. And this is kind of an attack of opportunity. When they make this disengage action, you roll a dice. On a 4+, they take D6 damage points. Now, we haven't really talked about wounds, and a lot of fighters in this game are between 10 and 20 wounds. Like 20, even like 18 or higher is considered a lot of wounds in Warcry. And a lot of your smaller fighters, you know, just your regular chumps, are 8, 10, maybe 12 wounds. So if you pop off and you roll a 5 or a 6 on that D6, you could chunk a huge amount of wounds off of any fighter that tries to run away from you. And I think this is going to put a lot of thought into your opponent as well. If they're trying to run away with a wounded fighter that only has 3 wounds left, strike them down can literally strike them down and just kill them.
Yeah, it's really cool. And I really like how, as you said, they've added this to the game, because now it allows players to maybe wait, right? Like when you make a wait action, mm-hmm. now you're able to, you know, be able to react to what your enemy is doing rather than, as you said earlier, kind of foresee what's already going to happen in the round. And again, you know, like you alternate until all fighters have activated. And in some cases, you might have less fighters than your opponent, right?
Mm-hmm.
And so this gives you that opportunity to maybe let them kind of make their choices, and then you can come and, you know, strike, or rather aptly react. And so reactions happen. So the way that it works is each reaction states when a fighter can make the reaction, as, you know, Zach had recapped them earlier. And this is also the point where a fighter must declare that that fighter will make that reaction. And for a fighter to be able to make a reaction, at least one of the following needs to be true. They either have to have not activated yet, or they had activated but they decided to use the wait action, or in some cases it's a campaign battle and the fighter has some sort of special ability called Level of Renown. But in most cases, unless you're doing a campaign, which I highly recommend, by the way, they're a lot of fun because mm-hmm. your fighters can like actually die or get like very grisly permanent injuries or even boons by the Chaos Gods. There are very specific circumstances, so it's not like your opponent's going to be blind. They're going to be like, okay, well, maybe you can react, and I know that, and I'm going to make that decision accordingly.
Yeah, and it does put a little bit of that mental game in, right? Like, they're going mm-hmm. to be like, oh, should I retreat because they could use strike them down as a reaction, or should I try to punch them, but then they could use counter as a reaction, or should I just activate with a different fighter so they can't make a reaction against this fighter that I care about not taking damage? And I think it's going to put a little bit of a fun mind game into the game.
Yeah, completely agree. And then I also think one of the best aspects about Warcry is it almost feels like the terrain itself is a character.
Mm-hmm.
Because there are so many different engaging rules that can be used. And I think some of the more fun aspects of it are, you know, how the obstacles perform. So there's like low terrain, there are platforms, you can fall off terrain, there's deadly terrain that can damage you, some terrain is unscalable, sometimes you can take stairs and ladders. And so it's just really cool to kind of immerse yourself in the more, I guess, technical aspects of it, because in Underworlds, you know, terrain is just a block hex or a lethal mm-hmm. hex or a cover hex, right? But in Warcry, like, you can actually get kicked off a platform and then you take fall damage, right?
Yeah. Which is pretty cool. And there's a lot of interesting things that they've added as well. Unscalable terrain, for instance, is... to clarify, in Warcry, you can climb anything. Low terrain, you can move over. That's just like ground scatter terrain. You don't have to subtract any movement while moving over it. But walls, platforms, stairs, old ruins, trees, even some trees anyway, are free game. You can climb up them. You could stand on top of them as long as you have the movement to do so. And one of the great things about Warcry is just that the movement is very free and open. You can just, you know, I'm going to move over here, run up this wall, climb on top of this platform, jump across to this bridge that's over here on the other side. And you can do that without, like, you know, having to, you know, consult a table or like use some sort of special ability or like check the rules to see if you can do it. It's just like, okay, no, you can just move and play this very dynamic mobile game. But adding this unscalable terrain is something nice because occasionally in the older editions, you would have like a fighter with fly, and fly models get to ignore verticality and terrain. A model with fly would just like jump to the top of a building that nobody else could climb or like on top of a statue or something. And now you can kind of be like, okay, this is an impassable terrain. You can't just like go hide up there or anything like that. So unscalable does right. add a little bit of to that. But yeah, like Iman said, there's also kicking people off terrain. This is another small change, but an interesting one for both new and returning players. Now, after every attack that you're targeted, if you're near the edge of terrain, I think if you're near a half inch of the edge of like a platform or something like that, after every attack that you take, you roll a dice, and on a one, you just fall off. You just fall off the building, which is hilarious because you can like fall off onto other models or like fall off onto dangerous terrain below. Maybe you fall on some spikes and take extra damage, or like you hit the ground mm-hmm. and take damage. And, it can really make some of these fights really fun because, you know, maybe the mission is pick up treasure and run with it. And the treasure's on top of a building and you run up there and you grab the treasure, and then somebody comes running up after you, and then they attack you and they kick you off a building. And, you know, it really feels like you're playing through a Warhammer novel or a video game or something like that.
Yeah. The immersion level, I think, is probably one of the more, like, this is the best aspects mm-hmm. of Warcry. Is that you can really get that feeling of this is a cinematic moment. And while we do that have that in Underworlds, right, like, you know, maybe like a squig with punching up and a bunch of cards and damage, you know, like one shots a Molog or a five wound fighter, like that's pretty cinematic. Or sometimes when you roll a double crit on defense, you know, to win the game, like that's cool. Mm-hmm. But in Warcry, you'll probably have a cinematic moment or multiple in every game. I mean, I think that's what's cool about it, which is why I really am looking forward to doing like a narrative campaign with some of my buddies. I'm trying to get them into the hobby because I want them to experience like their fighters maybe even dying or, you know, being maimed or getting boons and finding cool weapons, and really get them into that whole spirit of I'm invested in my fighters and my warband. And, you know, feel that anguish when like one of your favorite characters actually gets permadeath. You know, it's not fun, but it's part of the game, right? Reminds me a lot of Mordheim in a way.
Yeah, I mean, narrative isn't for everybody. I understand some people just like, you know, match play. You show up with your list, you kind of roll the dice, and then that interaction is over. But the campaigns are really fun. You kind of get the personalities of these fighters, and, you know, people even write their own little stories, and they'll do game recaps. I know it's really big in Blood Bowl, but I know when we did our Warcry campaign, you know, at the start of the first season back in 2019, people were like talking about like, oh, you know, my unmade leader went and did this, and he took the head of, you know, this untamed beast fighter, and now he like modeled a little head on the base of the his unmade leader. And it was really cool. Like, people really get into it. They really want their heroes to be heroic, right?
Absolutely. That's cool. What I really want to do is I'm going to like maybe like magnetize, like, or I'll just, what I'll put is I'll have a flag or a banner pole next to my leader, and for every enemy leader he kills, I'll just have like a flag painted in those colors. And so his goal is just going to take everyone's flags, like take their banners.
Nice, nice.
That'll look awesome. Kind of like the old fantasy rules.
Yeah. Oh, that's fun.
There's a lot of cool stuff you can do if you want to get into the more immersive side of it. But like Underworlds, Warcry offers a ton of tokens that come with the game. These tokens range from activation tokens to waiting tokens, battle group tokens, objective markers, even damage and spend action tokens, which is pretty cool. Mm-hmm. So that's a very familiar aspect of it. Unlike Underworlds, though, your warband can ally with other types of fighters. And effectively, allies are powerful fighters from other factions that can be included in your warband. And essentially, they have to have the hero rune mark, which Zach mentioned earlier, as well as the ally rune mark. And then there are some stipulations, but effectively you can have like thralls, which are beasts, like chaotic beasts, or maybe, you know, something from, I don't know, whatever. And every Grand Alliance has some, you know, thralls. Then, of course, we have monsters, which is probably the coolest one. I know that in the rulebook there's a picture of a giant Charybdis, which is a order monster from the Druchi or the Dark Elves. Mm-hmm. You know, so you can have like a giant monster at some point if you want. There's like the Ogroid Myrmidon, which I think is probably the coolest one out of the bunch. Mine. Yeah, he looks super cool.
And this is really interesting because monsters were before just kind of like this challenge thing, and you could sometimes add them in a campaign. Now this is kind of like a baseline addition. Mm-hmm. And I think we're going to see a lot of people make a warband with a monster in it. Every monster, and I actually pulled out my Monsters and Mercenaries book, which is where they first introduced monsters, in my Grand Alliance books from the current edition of Warcry, which have all the kind of the Grand Alliance monsters. Every monster is above 300 points, so these things are going to be a third of your faction, a third of your warband. But they're all huge and have really powerful attacks and have really cool abilities. So putting one in your faction is like going to make you very elite, because you're only going to have, you know, a third of it or two thirds of the models you normally would. But it's going to look really cool when you put down that, you know, Gorgon or that Charybdis, like you said, or that. I don't know what some of the other ones are. I think there's like a zombie dragon for death. That you can put down.
There's a bunch of stuff.
There's a lot of very cool monsters in the game.
Yeah. But don't worry, Underworlds fans. Unlike the current state of the meta, Warcry is not dominated by only death warbands. So don't worry.
That's true.
You can play whatever Grand Alliance you want and have a lot of fun with it. And I know that some people in the past have mentioned like Warcry warbands, you know, that are marketed as Warcry warbands, mm-hmm. can be weaker than, you know, custom-made warbands using warbands from the greater AOS range. I don't believe that's going to be the case moving forward. And while we can't get into details, I can confirm that we have received the Warcry Compendium, which is going to update and provide rules for a bunch of other factions, fighters, and Grand Alliances. Unfortunately, while we did receive it, and we can say that we have it, GW has not allowed us to discuss it further than that, but stay tuned because we will be covering that later in August.
Yeah, it'll be very exciting. And to your point about Warcry warbands being weaker, I think that GW has taken that into account and has probably balanced it. I haven't looked at the compendium yet. I kind of hope they have, because that was one of the main complaints in the previous edition. But also, just like, balance in Warcry is such a nebulous concept, because like we said, it is first and foremost a casual or narrative game. Yes, there is, you can play it as a tournament, you can play it match play, but ultimately it's for you and your friends to have a good time. So if you show up with, you know, this teeth kicking list, and your opponent shows up with just you know, the Warcry warband they bought out of a single box, and they just have what they have, maybe you should just kind of step back and figure out a fun way to play together that doesn't make anyone else feel bad. It's a collaborative
to be effort. Fair, and I completely agree. I will say that Warcry is one of those games where, like, you know, if your opponent even has maybe even if they have an inferior list, mm-hmm. if they roll hot,
oh yeah, it doesn't matter. You can crit out for sure. Absolutely,
you can definitely have the ability to do that. I will say, while I can't confirm what I have seen in the compendium, mm-hmm. I don't think that's going to be an issue.
Oh, interesting. Well, we'll take that grain of salt with us.
Yes, because we cannot discuss the compendium now. Well, for now at least. But I think you made a really good segue. You talked about match play, and this is kind of like the bread and butter for Underworlds players, mm-hmm. right? We love competitive games, and yes, you can play casual Underworlds. But Zach, you and I really enjoy and appreciate sweaty Underworlds, right?
Absolutely.
Where we can get really, really into our games and try to grind them out and prove that we're the superior player. Now, match play focuses on creating as fair as leveling field as possible when playing Warcry. Now, take that with a grain of salt, because Warcry is not necessarily designed to be a competitive game, perhaps like Underworlds or even Kill Team, which has done a really good job in the most recent edition to feel a bit more competitive. But I think this is going to give us an opportunity for players to really demonstrate their ability to pilot a Warcry warband, if you will, against one another. And so, Zach, why don't you take us through some of the biggest, stipulations of match play?
Yeah, so match play is really just Warcry, just limited. It doesn't change anything here about your list, which is really interesting, because it means you can make match play lists with monsters and thralls and all these other things that you may not have had access to in the past. But basically what happens is some of the cards that you will draw to set up your battlefield, to set up your mission and things like this, some of them are deliberately one-sided, right? Like, you'll have terrain that is set up where one side of the board has a bunch of really thick terrain, all the walls and stuff, and the other side doesn't. And that sort of terrain is supposed to indicate, like, oh, you know, in this battlefield, somebody is setting up an encampment and another side is attacking that encampment. So the defenders have a battlefield advantage. Sometimes the deployment is stilted where one team will set up in the middle and the other team will get to kind of surround them. But what there is on some of these cards is a match play rune mark, previously the symmetrical rune mark. And when you play a match play mission, you only use the cards that have the match play rune mark, which is to say, these are the cards that are designed to give a balance thing. There is not one person's at a disadvantage. There's not one person gets the positional advantage. There is not the terrain is stilted towards one side of the board or another. It is the terrain and the deployment and the missions are designed where both players have an equal shot at winning. And it's not really a attacker defender or like a, an encamped person and a sieging person or anything like that. So you'll use the cards that are designed to be as symmetrical as possible. The other thing in match play is that you don't draw a twist card, which I think twists are a really fun, exciting part of Warcry, but they can lead to some very strange, stilted matchups. Like, you know, there is a twist card that says you can't see enemies outside of 6 inches. And if I've built an entire faction around shooting, like if I'm playing Caradhran Overlords, which are the dwarves with guns, and every single model of mine has a gun, well, that twist card really sucks, doesn't it? So it makes sense why they have kind of taken the twists out of match play. And then there's just a stipulation here about placing objective tokens and treasure tokens. Basically, you can't place them in such a way that it's like impossible for people to get to them, or, you know, it favors one person over the other based on whatever other stuff. But really, it's just to say match play is Warcry. It's base Warcry, except you're only using the stuff that favors everyone equally. And I think it's nice for them to call it out. Like, it allows them to have this open play where things are wild and wacky, and sometimes you're going to have really stilted battles where one person's fighting uphill. But then you can just kind of go back together and be like, okay, well, we want a nice fair mission this time. Let's play a match play mission. And it's really easy. Like I said, you just use the cards that have the logo and you play everything else exactly the same.
Yeah, it's really cool. You know, super simple. And to be fair, like, as you mentioned, it just makes the playing field as level as possible. So if there is a way in which you can play Sweaty Warcry, which there might be, you know, there might be a lot of match play support for Warcry moving forward. We can only talk about our past experiences. But I think this could be a great way to play Warcry in a manner in which can be significantly more competitive and organized.
And they have talked about adding organized play support for 40K and AOS and Kill Team and Underworlds. We'll see if we get that for Warcry as well. I know people really, really like Underworlds trophies. Like, it was those acrylic trophies, or were they?
They were glass, bro.
Well, they were shade glass, yes. Those shade glass trophies, those were a big part of why people went to tournaments, you know, and like played in local leagues and stuff like that. So I think if they do something like that for Warcry, you'll definitely get people out and playing games and rolling dice.
Yeah, I mean, I think they used to give coins, like giant, like a gold, bronze, and silver coin
for Warcry. That's true. Yeah, I think they did have that for a while.
I would be surprised if organized play did not come back. But if you know, maybe you don't have a local GW or your local store isn't running, you know, or having these kits, it doesn't matter, because in the rules there are, you know, guidelines for running a Warcry tournament, which is pretty cool. And it talks about how many players are there, how players should be paired, how to do tiebreakers. You can have special quests that players can use in a tournament to make it more fun, to, you know, for awarding players with additional victory conditions. But then also it's a great tiebreaker as well. There's even a section that mentions you can introduce kill points, and that can be another tiebreaker, because if you have more than 20 players, some people can tie for first place. And I think this is really cool, because they're literally telling you, we want you to run tournaments, we expect you to run tournaments, and this is how you can do it, which is sick.
Yeah, and I think that's really because this tournaments are how a lot of people interact with the hobby. You know, not everyone has a regular game night, but a lot of people will travel to a tournament or like a place will host. And for some people, it's not about winning glory or, you know, winning a trophy or store credit or whatever the people's doing. For some people, it's just like, hey, man, I want to get 4 or 5 games in a single day. And tournaments are great for that.
Yeah, I wholeheartedly agree. I think this is going to be really exciting. And I think, you know, if my local store has a Warcry tournament, I'm going to go. I'll try it out. And if I like it, I might keep playing it. And that's really exciting for me, because I think it's a really fun game and I can't wait to play some Silence of the Flame.
Yeah, for sure, for sure.
And if there's anyone from GW listening, please make them an Underworlds Warband.
I think that would look so cool on a tabletop.
Yeah, I think they're perfect. But if you're not someone who is into tournament play, right? If you think that the word competitive isn't something that you're comfortable with, or that you feel like that takes away from your fun, then I would say you can check out narrative play if open play isn't scratching that itch. And the narrative play in this rulebook is incredible. They are, gosh, I'm just like flipping through this right now. It goes from page 99 all the way to, it's still going over 140, 150. I mean, there's like so many pages about how to play a narrative campaign. You can go on quests. You can go on chaotic quests. You know, your fighters can die. They can gain heroic traits. I mean, you name it. There's so many cool things that you can do. Have you ever played a narrative campaign?
Yeah, we did. The narrative campaigns in the first edition of Warcry were interesting, but they were kind of limited. Like, the campaigns were just kind of, it gave a little bit of fluff, told you which missions to do at certain points to, like, you know, tie in with the fluff. Like, oh, if you're playing Corvus Cabal, play this mission on your third mission of your campaign. But this is really fleshed it out. Like, you have different quests that you're going to pick up and do. You know, those quests kind of come and go, and they all have different unique things. There's faction specific quests, but there's also Grand Alliance specific ones. I believe we're going to see some more in the compendium as well. I could be mistaken about that, but again, that's my assumption from what they've said so far. Just the breadth and scope of the sort of quests and campaigns that you can go on it's one of the more fun parts of it. And like we talked about with, you know, name your characters and watching them gain glory and then watching them die tragically at the hands of your opponent. That's like one of the big, big parts of the game.
Yeah. I mean, I remember, I was talking to one of my buddies, my local gamers, and he was like, yeah, you know, because I was telling him, I was like, hey, that new Warcry looks really cool. And I've seen him play it before. And he was like, yeah, I don't know. I've just been jaded. I'm like, what's wrong, man? Like, is everything okay? He's like, well, dude, like, I had this really cool guy. He, like, you know, I killed so many things, and I had, like, a really powerful warlord. And, yeah, you know, he was fighting some small, like, diminutive goblin or whatever, and then he fell off a thing, and I just rolled really bad on the damage chart, and he died.
Oh, no, that's so sad.
And I
sad.
Was like, I'm so sorry to hear that, man. And he'd like, yeah, dude, I played, like, 20, 30 games with him, you know, and so he's like, every time he got a kill, I gave him a new tattoo. So, like, he took it to a whole other level, right? Like, continued to paint and hobby by giving his, like, you know, a tattoo to his fighter.
Yeah.
And I was like, man, I'm so sorry to hear that.
I know a lot of Blood Bowl guys who do the same thing. They have, like, their, you know, their, I mean, there are star players, but they have, like, their player, their star player who's, like, their guy. And then it's like, and then he like got hit by an ogre and he died, like his neck broke, and I like quit my entire league because of it. You know, it's always so funny to hear people's stories when they talk about their favorite narrative portions. So, and you know, Warcry's got that, man, and I think that's the thing that gets people coming back, is they get that feeling. They're like, oh, you know, I just picked up these new Slaanesh miniatures. And I really think they would, you know, I can make a cool story about like this warband striking out into Gur to, you know, go bring the Dark Prince's pleasure to the heart of the wilds or something. And yeah, I think there's going to be so much of that in this new edition of Warcry.
Yeah, I'm pretty excited for it. And the immersion, again, is as much as you want it. You know, like you could just not care if your hero dies or your particular fighter, or you can, you know, be really invested. And I think it's a really cool way of, again, immersing yourself not only in the game and in your community, but in your hobby in some cases, right? By giving your fighter, you know, different weapons or conversions or magnetization or tattoos. It's really cool. So I think Zach and I are both very excited to try the new edition of Warcry, the Heart of Gur, Skirmish Combat in the Realm of Beasts. However, I think we're going to pivot now, and we're going to talk about the two new warbands that come in the box set. And so they are called the Horns of Hashut and the Rottmire Creed. Now, visually, they're both very striking. And what I thought was really interesting. So first thing I found out is the Horns of Hashut. Hashut is the Chaos Dwarf God, right?
Yeah.
Dwarden, Chaotic Dwarden God.
Well,
from the old world.
From the old world, yeah.
Yeah.
They made a slight appearance in AOS, but these are actually the first like true Hashut worshipping models that have come out since Age of Sigmar is released.
That's really cool.
Yeah. But it's weird because they're not dwarves.
Well, maybe they are a hint of yet what's to come. Because, you know, I'm sure he has human followers as well. Oh, yeah. You know, you never know. Oh, yeah. And so we'll see how that works. But it was really funny. So they have this weapon. And, you know, I get it. It's like a horned god. Or they have that kind of bull or Taurus aesthetic to it. And so instead of a trident, they have a bident.
I know. I saw the name and I was giggling as well.
Yeah.
Because it's the two pointy parts.
Yeah, and I forgot, I thought I read bidet the first time, and I was like, wait, what? But it's a bident, which is very very punny, but also on brand for G-Dub, which I can appreciate.
For sure.
And then the Rottmire Creed, I feel like, are more leaning into Nurgle. Like, you can see the rot and the damage and the... Gosh, I don't even know.
Yeah, you know, it's going back to, like, those Season 1 warbands where they don't know their... Like, they don't know the word Nurgle. They don't even know, like, Chaos God of Decay is a thing. Mm-hmm. They worship the swamp, and they worship rot and disease. And, hey, guess what? That's real. You know, we know as kind of the... omnipotent third person who that is and what that is, but it's really cool to see kind of like at the ground level, what are these people like? They're not covered in Nurgle tattoos or like Nurgle iconography. They don't look like Blight Lords, but they're very clearly still another Nurgle warband. So I think they've done a really great job at expressing these mortals in the realms doing what they're doing.
Yeah, they just like they. I think you're absolutely correct in terms of the design, but also, like, I remember, like, reading on Warcom, like, they are followers of a Lord Leech.
Yeah, that's what it is.
Like, they don't know that Nurgle is Nurgle, as you said, they're Lord Leech.
Yeah, and maybe Lord Leech is just, like, a demon prince of Nurgle that's sitting here kind of soaking up all this praise. Or maybe it is just a manifestation of him, but, you know, it's kind of left up to the player how they want to interpret that.
Yeah. My favorite is the leader with the three-eyed frog, which is pretty, or toad or whatever, but also like the giant needle gun injection thing.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
That's pretty cool.
There's some really great miniatures here. Personally, I like the Horns of Hishut better. How about you, Iman?
Definitely. I'm a Taurus.
Oh, okay.
I mean, this speaks to me on so many different levels. I like guns. I like flamethrowers. And I like tridents, so I don't see why I wouldn't like a bident.
True, yeah, it's just kind of like a trident, but slightly less.
Yes, slightly less or slightly more, depending on your perspective.
Mm.
So there are 7 different fighter profiles for the Horns of Hishut. Why don't we start talking about them? So their leaders are called Ruinator Alphas, and there's two ways that you can, I suppose, equip them. You can give one a war bident, which at this point you must. or you can give him a heavy flail. Zach, what are your thoughts on the Ruinator Alpha for 165 points? And which one do you think is the better option of the two?
So 165 points for a 20 wound tough 4 leader. So if you're very new, the fighter cards are pretty simple. You have your move speed, move 4 inches is kind of the average in this game. 4 or 5 inches is probably about the average. You have your toughness. Most things are toughness 3 or 4. Toughness 5 is very tough. Toughness 2 is very weak. And then you have your wound count. These leaders, most of the Warcry leaders are 20 wounds, but then you have like very elite warbands like Stormcast. Even your basic dudes are like 18 or 20 wounds, or at mm-hmm. least they were in the previous edition. So going based off that, he's kind of a fairly basic Warcry leader. The weapon is where things stand out. Both these weapon options are range 2, which is great. Range 2 means you don't have to get into that 1-inch engagement zone, which means you don't have to make disengage moves. It means that you have a little bit more room with flexibility of movement. And since most other attacks in the game are range 1, it means you can attack and your opponent can't attack back. So having that range 2 baseline, great. So the War Bident rolls 3 dice, whereas the Heavy Flail rolls 4. They're both strength 4. They're both 2 damage base. The Bident is crit damage 5. The Flail is crit damage 4. Generally speaking, more dice is usually better. So that one extra dice on the Heavy Flail, I think a lot of people will go for that. But crit to 5 is really good because that means you only need 2 crits to kill most mooks, because most, you know, little chump things in the game are, again, 10 wounds. So crit 5 means you roll 2 sixes and those guys are gone, whereas the flail is going to need 2 sixes and a hit as well. So there's like a little bit of a toss up there. I think it's going to come down to personal taste. I think that's going to come down to which one you like the look of more. And it sounds like for you, that's going to be the Bident.
Well, I mean, it's almost, I almost must have to now at this point. I do like more dice, you know, even in Underworlds. I love when I can get more dice because I can crit, you know, more propensity to crit.
Yes.
And so I can definitely appreciate and understand the sentiment. But at some point, a man must make principles and stand by them. And I think I'm just going to go with the Biden because A, it's fun. B, it looks cool, man.
True, true.
So, cool. So the baseline, so, you know, you have your alpha and then you have just regular ruinators. And so this is the more elite fighters in your warband. Very similar stat line to what Zach mentioned earlier. What I find of interest is they have four dice on their bident, whereas the alpha only has three.
Yeah, but it's only range one, so maybe it's like a short-handled one. You just like it's like a shiv almost.
That could be could. Maybe like a little pitchfork or like a barbecue stick.
Yeah, something like that.
Yeah.
But these guys look pretty good. I mean, you've got toughness 4 with 15 wounds, which is like a nice medium-sized fighter. Like Iman said, they've got four dice at damage 2-4, which is a solid kind of like base fighter. That is like, this is a mid-sized fighter. When he gets in with things, he's going to be able to fight it out pretty well. So I think these guys are solid. 125 points, you could do a lot worse.
That's true. Do you want to take the next one? I think this one might be the coolest.
Well, this is the one that everyone's excited about. This is the Demolisher with Flame Hurler. So this is your flamethrower fighter. This is kind of, you know, the Demolishers are kind of the step down from the Ruinators. So these guys only have 12 wounds. And they're 100. This one's 125 points. We have another Demolisher with weapon coming up after this. But the Flame Hurler is range 6. So this is the first range weapon we've seen in this warband. And I believe the only one. 3 dice, strength 5, damage 1-5. That's a pretty respectable little gun. I mean, range 6 is nothing special, especially when you compare it to like Caradhran Overlords or Lumineth or Cities of Sigma or something. But I think, you know, just having that little bit of extra range on a reasonably priced model with reasonably okay defenses, you can kind of get on an objective and shoot or kind of back up your Ruinators that are going to go forward, and then the Demolisher stand behind the Flamethrowers and kind of back them up. So yeah, very solid little piece here. I would be interested, because I don't have the models in front of me, I would be interested to hear if you could build multiple Flame Hurlers out of the box or if there's just the one on the sprue, but I guess we'll see that as the pre-orders go up and we see more information.
Yeah, I mean, so I think they've released the sprue, but if not, when you pre-order it, you can see it.
Yeah.
I am looking at it right now, and I think you can only build one.
I wouldn't be surprised. A lot of these times, some of these fancier weapons, they only put one in the box.
Yeah, there is only one that I see in here.
But that's not that big of a deal, because we have two other Demolisher configurations. There's Demolisher with Crushing Weapon and Shield, and then there's Demolisher with Crushing Weapons, which is kind of the paired weapons version. What do you think about the melee versions of these, Iman?
Yeah, well, so, I mean, I definitely like the fact that they are still on the heavier side of the wound pool, mm-hmm. You know, with most people being around 10. I mean, again, they're not as beefy as the Ruinators, but ultimately, I think there's some pretty good standard infantry fighters. I think in this situation, you're just going to want to go for either toughness or dice, because the weapon profiles are fairly similar, except for the fact that the crushing weapons, which is the dual wield, gets 4 dice. But when you have a shield, you go to 5 toughness. So depending on how you're, you know, outfitting your warband, I think I might go shield. Just because I think, A, it looks cool, but B, I like that toughness 5. If you just want to, you know, chop stuff up, nothing wrong with crushing weapons.
Yeah, and for those who are new, and just going to quickly go through some of the base rules here, the way toughness and strength works is if the strength of the weapon is higher than the toughness of the target, you need 3 ups to hit, 3 or higher to hit. if they're equal strength to toughness, you need 4 or higher to hit. If the weapon is weaker than the toughness, you need 5 or higher to hit. So going to that toughness 5 means that strength 4 weapons, which is a lot of weapons in the game, are now only hitting on 5s and 6s as opposed to 4s, 5s, and 6s. So yeah, I think that 4 to 5 jump is kind of nice, especially when it's just a little guy that's going to be trying to hold down objectives or trying to run away with treasure or something. Just surviving a little bit longer is kind of nice.
Yeah. I mean, I think it's certainly like the aesthetic that I'm getting from this warband is, you know, average speed, tough, hits hard, which I kind of like.
Yeah.
And so 105 is a great point cost. Shatterers are like the, I guess, what you would call mook.
Yeah, that's the term I use, but yeah.
Yeah. And so why don't you round them out with the mooks?
Sure. So your shatterers are your little guys. These guys are only tough 3. They're only 10 wounds, so they're going to explode to basically every weapon in the game. But nicely, they do get spears. So for 55 points, you get a guy with a range 2 weapon. Yes, it's only 3 dice. It's only strength 3, but it is damage 1-4, so you can kind of move shatterers up the field. You can zone out range 1 fighters. You can even run them into something big and scary and then roll dice and hope for 6s, because critting on 4 or critting to 4 damage is really nice. Like, you can do some serious damage if you roll 2 or even 3 6s if you get that mega box cars. So these are a really nice, you know, like you said, way to round it out. You've got a lot of big fighters. You got a solid amount of mid-sized fighters. These are your little fighters, and they have a job to do, and they can do it pretty well.
I love that. And I think the lore behind these guys are really cool. You know, like, they, even though they worship a Duardan Chaos God, or rather, I don't know if Chaos is the right word, but an evil Duardan God, who's described in the the warband tome as a shadowy deity with unquenchable lust for domination and cruelty. These guys have literally pledged themselves to his worship and to follow the commands of his followers. So it says right here, they're actually sent out on missions by Duardan. And because they grew up and have spent their entire lives amidst the hellish fiery wastelands, favored by chaos-worshipping Duardan, they like lack any compassion and mercy. And the whole idea is that they follow the brutal and overwhelming violence that their deity prefers, which is the way of the Raging Taurus. You know, kind of synergizes with me here. A headlong stampede that crushes the foe entirely, rendering them incapable of fighting back. And that cool helmet that the Ruinator Alpha and the Ruinators are wearing, it's like, not only is it a symbol of office, but it's just like an actual artifact of fell power as well. So, very cool lore for the Horns of Hashut.
Yeah, and, you know, it's really cool to see that kind of expanded upon, because Hashut kind of like as this Chaos Duardan God, this the way they worshipped him was kind of simplistic, and it was just like, hey, we're evil dwarves and we have slaves, and now they're kind of rounding it out. It's like, okay, well, there are these other people that worship him, and, you know, they do live in this sort of society where there is a caste system, and humans are on a lower caste, but they're still not slaves like the hobgoblins are. So it's cool to see them kind of flesh that out a little bit more, and especially if they're going to bring Chaos Duardan into Age of Sigmar, which I hope they do, because that's a really cool aesthetic. You know, now we're getting a little bit more about them and a little bit more interest out of them. So, yeah, it's great to hear.
Yeah, very excited about what's to come, but also excited with what's already arrived, which is this particular warband. Why don't we go over their faction rules, specifically their abilities and reaction?
Sure. So starting from the top, we've got their reaction. So unlike all the other reactions we've seen so far, this does have a rune mark associated with it. rune marks again are just little icons on the card. This rune mark means it's available to every unit except the Shatterers. So all your Runators and your Demolishers, anybody except your little dudes can do this. So it's a reaction when an enemy fighter finishes a move within 3 inches. So if an enemy fighter approaches them, you roll a dice. And if it's equal or greater to that enemy fighter's toughness, they take 3 points of damage and take -1 from their strength characteristic of melee attacks until the end of the battle round. What do you think about this, Iman?
You know, it's a really interesting reaction. I think if you roll hot, you can do some serious damage with this stuff. And I kind of really like it.
Yeah, and, you know, subtracting 1 from strength is no slouch either, since all your guys are tough 4 or even better. Knocking that strength 4 attack that's coming into you down to 3 or 5 down to 4, so they're only hitting on 4s instead of 3s, like, that's no joke. You can really neuter somebody's damage with that, so.
Yeah, further emphasizes the more tough aspect, you know, the ability to soak damage.
Mm-hmm.
Which is pretty neat, as well as deal damage, which I'm really a big fan of.
So then we've got our regular abilities. So first we have a double, and this is Merciless Cruelty. This is available to everybody in the warband. The next attack action made by this fighter, this activation, scores a critical hit on a 5+ if the target fighter already has 5 or more damage points allocated to them. So this is really just kind of like a finisher, right? Like, it makes it easier to crit if the opponent's already wounded. And considering you have some pretty good crit damage, again, you got crit 5 on your Bident leader. You got crit 5 on your... and this doesn't specify melee attacks, so it actually works on your Flame Hurler, on your Flamethrower. You could be getting 5 damage on 5s and 6s with your Flamethrower, which is really, really nice. You got a lot of 4 damage crits on everybody else. So, yeah, this is a solid little double, I think.
Yeah, agreed.
Next, we got Stampede of Iron. Until the end of this fighter's activation, the next time this fighter finishes a move within 1 inch of an enemy fighter, pick a visible enemy fighter within 1 inch and roll a dice on a 4 to 5. That enemy fighter takes 1 damage. On a 6, they take damage points equal to the value of this ability. Value of this ability is the face of the dice that was rolled during the initiative step. So if it's a double 6, it's 6 damage. If it's a double 2, it's only 2 damage. What do you think about this impact hit?
So again, you know, like Warcry, you know, we want to roll dice. We want to have some fun.
Mm-hmm.
And I think this is kind of giving me the idea that, you know, kind of similar to Iron Skulls Boys and Underworlds, where rolling dice with favorable results can lead you to do cooler things.
Mm-hmm.
And so the idea here is that if you're going to high roll on some dice, you can, again, keep damaging through your abilities, which is what I really like. Because this warband seems to be able to output a lot and play in theme of just trying to utterly destroy their warband. So I think this, in conjunction with the reaction, can be some cool ways in which the warband can get some damage, I suppose. I guess the best way to explain it is, I guess without having to roll as much?
Yeah, I mean, you're doing it without making an attack or using an activation. Like, these sort of impact hits are great because when you're making a move action, you're not making an attack action, but now your move action can potentially deal damage as well.
Yeah.
Yeah, and I think you're right that it's very nice to be able to do extra damage on top of the damage you're already doing.
Yeah.
And that is available to, same as your reaction, everybody except the Shatterers.
Yeah, and for those of you who may not necessarily have the book or are not familiar with the way these abilities work, some abilities can be landlocked to rune specific rune marks, and every fighter card has rune marks that identify them, and there's a ton. There's a ton of rune marks.
There's like 3 pages worth of rune marks, I think, or something like that.
Yeah. I think they started out with just like 8. And, well, a lot of the rune marks are like warband symbols. Mm-hmm. But they can do quite a bit.
Yeah, and I think one of the common complaints I see is a lot of the rune marks look very similar. So when you're looking at it from like 3 feet away, like say you have your little card on the table and you're trying to reference which fighter has which ability, you're like, I think like 3 or 4 of them is a skull surrounded by spikes in different configurations. And so you're like, yeah, all right, is that the leader one? Or is that the elite one? Or is that the bruiser one? Oh, they all kind of look the same.
Warrior, minion, hero, and champion all have a very similar aesthetic. I would say warrior, champion, and hero being the ones you would confuse the most, but
yeah,
the fact that most fighters are one of those four doesn't
yeah, especially happen in this warband, they're all kind of together.
Yeah.
It's fun. I mean, it's not really a big issue once you kind of get used to it, because once you get into the game and you kind of know your warband, you know which fighters have access to which abilities, and you don't really need to look it up as much. But when you're learning, it can be a little bit confusing for sure. Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. Next, we have another double. So this is 3 doubles for the warband, which is quite a bit. Usually it's 2 doubles, 3 triples or something like that. This double is only available to the leader, and it is Lay to Waste. You can only use this if you've killed an enemy fighter in this same activation. You make a bonus move or a bonus attack action, which is bonus actions are really, really good. I mean, if you play Underworlds, you know how good it is to be able to get a free attack or remake an attack or like make a free movement or even get a free push for one hex is like really good. And here it's the same thing, you know, you only have so many activations. Getting a, you know, free action economy out of it is just icing on the cake. It's awesome.
Yeah. This is like ready for action.
Yes. You do have to kill something, though.
Yeah.
But it's, if anyone's familiar, if you're not familiar with a lot of the existing warbands, there are a lot of warbands that have bonus move action or bonus attack action. But usually it's like on a quad, so you need to roll really hot for it, or it's like on a triple and you have to also fulfill some other sort of condition in order to do it. Like for it to be a double and to be for the only condition to be kill an enemy fighter and it's on your best fighter that is probably going to be doing most of your killing anyway, is like, that's some good synergy. I think you're going to see a good amount of Horns of Hishut players like, you're just going to throw your leader out there. He's going to kill something. He's going to kill like a little dude, use Lay to Waste, make a move, get into, you know, base contact with another fighter and then make another attack action. And he's just going to like go do crazy combat type stuff.
Yeah, that's the dream.
Next we've got Engulfing Flames of Dark Artifice. This is for the flamethrower only is the rune mark on here. Pick a visible enemy fighter within 6 inches. Roll a number of dice equal to the value of this ability. Again, that is the face, so it could be 2 dice, could be 6 dice, or anywhere in between. For each 4+, the enemy fighter takes 3 points of damage, and then you do the same in an area around as well. What do you think about this one?
I mean, it's pretty solid. I mean, it kind of gets the idea of that, like, you know, this is a bombardier slash, you know, flamer who is just trying to get out there and cause as much damage and devastation with their flamethrower. And so I kind of like the aesthetic of it. It's just like find an enemy fighter and then just kind of light them up, which is really cool. And again, can offer a lot of ways in which, you know, your particular fighter can deal a lot of damage. That being said, I'm sure a lot of people will try to target your flamethrower because he can do some pretty large numbers of damage, especially when you're rolling critical hits.
Oh, yeah.
So it's definitely something that you're going to want to take advantage of before they go down.
Yeah, that's true. I think, like you said, the flamethrower is going to be have a big target on its back. Then we've got Ash Bomb. This is a triple. This is available to, again, everybody except the Shatterers. So all your armored dudes. Pick a visible point within 6 inches of this fighter on the battlefield and place a token. token is an ash bomb token. While an enemy fighter is within 3 inches of any ash bomb tokens, they have -1 toughness and -1 from their attacks characteristics, both to a minimum of 1. At the end of the battle round, remove the token. So this is interesting because we didn't have a whole lot of put down a token and an effect lingers in the past. So to kind of have this thing where it's like, you know, you put out an effect and not only does it affect a big area around it that you can move away from, it also kind of lingers. So if you do this triple as your first, your first activation, you run a dude up, you throw down an ash bomb, you've now created kind of this zone of exclusion that your opponents don't want to go in, and it lingers for the entire round. I think that's going to be, that's really cool. And I think it adds a lot of interest to the game because, again, now you have stuff that's not just, you know, damage or a bonus move or a bonus attack. Now you also have terrain, effectively create terrain or effectively, modify the battlefield in some way. So I think it's not only very powerful because minus dice and minus toughness is great, but it's also just really cool in general.
Yeah, I mean, in addition to what you said, I think one of the cooler things about it is that it also provides like some sort of zoning, you know, some control based elements, like if you know that your opponent's going to go for a certain objective on the board or a certain area and you throw this ash bomb, then it can disincentivize them from moving there. So that is another technical or competitive aspect of it. But ultimately, I think I really like the fact that it's also like a damage modifier, which is really, really cool.
Yeah, for sure. It's multifunctional, and I think you'll see a lot of people using this in interesting ways.
Mm-hmm. Well, now we get to the quad, baby.
The quad. So I think to talk about this first, we should just really quick talk about the universal quad. There's a quad available to everybody in the game, which is Rampage. And that is you make a bonus move and make a bonus attack. So most of the time, your faction quads are going to be either some version of Rampage or like Rampage Plus. So these guys, their quad is the fighter makes a bonus melee attack action. So you don't get the move, you just get a bonus attack. In addition, add 1 to the damage points allocated by each critical hit scored from that bonus attack action. So while Rampage will get you a move and attack, this will just get you an attack, but you have better crit damage. For fighters that are rolling 4 dice, like your Ruinators, like your paired weapons guys, that's not bad. You are getting a pretty good chance at making crits and just therefore getting the extra damage out of it. So it's not exciting because it's not like, you know, oh, do something wild and wacky like the ash bomb or like impact hits. It's just very straightforward. You're getting an extra attack. You're getting extra bonuses on that attack. You're going to use it when you have it.
Yeah. Well, the thing is that like because it's restricted to brutes, but your leader is a brute, this actually makes me want to play with the heavy flail more now.
Oh, true.
Because you get more synergy out of it because you get that extra dice, which means you have the extra ability to score a critical hit. And then at that point, you're doing just as much damage as the war bident because it's doing 5 on critical instead of 4, which I think is pretty neat.
Yeah, there's a nice little balancing act there. And I think if you're... once these guys come out in their standalone box, I think you'll see people run maybe multiple Ruinators because you're right, that quad does have the icon that only Ruinators and Ruinator Alphas can use it. I think you might see people pick up a couple boxes and run multiple Ruinator Alphas because you can run up to 3 heroes in your warband. So you might get a couple of those in your list and take advantage of it.
That way I can still run the Bident.
The Bident.
Well, right on. So what are your overall thoughts on the Horns of Hashut?
I think you hit the nail on the head when you were talking about it. They are kind of big and beefy, you know, mid-movement, mid-size in terms of, like, number of models in the warband. But they have some really tough dudes, and they have some good hitting power, and they have... not necessarily a whole lot of like tricks, you know, they don't have like teleporting or resurrection or anything wild like that, but they do have a lot of cool incidental damage. And I think if you're looking for a warband that's just like, yeah, I want to fight, I want to brawl, I want to be in the arena killing dudes as a gladiator, like, this is going to be one of the warbands for you.
Agreed. Agreed. By fire be purged. So the next warband and the second one in the set is the Rahmire Creed. They're described as connoisseurs of disease and putrefaction, and they have a really interesting like background story. So it's really interesting. Like, I forget, like in the realm of Gur, everything is trying to eat everything, right? So the coastline itself, the actual coastline, was trying to eat an island. Okay. But the island had been infected by the worshippers of Nurgle, and when the landmass ate it, it infected a river and it led to the creation of the Rotmire, like, or this swampy area. And it's really interesting. The individuals who live here, they initially were part of the city of Excelsis, and their goal was to experiment on unwilling, what's the correct term here? Patience.
Mm-hmm.
And unwillingly, you know, would kidnap them, capture them, or maybe test their concoctions on criminals. And the idea was to eradicate disease within the city. So they were trying to build antidotes and medicines. But Nurgle found out about it and got pissed. And so when they ran away from the city because they were uncovered and doing these experiments on people that, you know, shouldn't never be experimented upon, Nurgle was like, I'm going to make these guys follow me instead. So this group of people who had a really noble goal and mission ended up becoming, you know, further followers of the Plague Lord itself. So pretty cool.
Yeah.
Very sad.
They love to do cautious tales or something like that in Warhammer, don't they? They love to see people with noble intentions getting corrupted by chaos. It's like 90% of the Primarchs.
Yeah, you either die a hero or live long enough to become the villain in Warhammer.
Exactly.
And death is usually very brutal. I have to read this quote because I think it just is so weird. It says, "The shaking will come first, so violent that your spine will crack and your jaw will shatter. Then the boils, the sputtering lesions, the skin sloughing away in fistfuls. These are only the earliest and most minor symptoms of the headman's gripe. Of course, the worst of it comes though somewhere around the seventh day." Can you believe that? Your spine will crack and your jaw will shatter, and your skin will start peeling off, and that's the only minor symptoms.
Dude, that is so evocative. I love it.
Wild. Very cool lore. Good job.
Yeah. Yeah, no, 100% GW. Like I said, I think Warcry, in terms of like narrative and aesthetic, just it knocks it out of the park.
Yeah, 100%. Shout out to the design team. But let's talk about their rules, right? So they're led by a Witherlord. And a Witherlord is, I guess, the bloke, if you will, with a giant three-eyed frog and giant syringe that they infect people with for fun. And so he's got a range of 2, 4 dice on his attack, 4 strength. It hits pretty solidly. 3 damage regularly, critting into 5s. I think that's higher than the Ruinator, the Alpha Ruinator. Yeah, they're 2 and 5 and 2 and 4.
It is. And outside of the very elite warbands, base damage 3 is pretty rare. So this is actually a very, very scary attack. And at range 2 as well. So really solid for 175 points.
Yeah. And he has, you know, that 4 toughness and 20 wounds. So, in fact, I think he's almost better than the Ruinator.
For 10 points more, you're getting
one more damage?
You want one more base damage, which is, yeah. I mean, I'd say that it's worth the 10 points. I don't know if it's better because, you know, points is points, but like if the two of them go straight up against each other, I think the Witherlord wins.
Yeah. I guess you can just take less Witherlords.
That's true. Yeah. Yeah. Probably not running two or three of these.
Yeah. Makes sense. Well, then we have the bloated one with a Raker Claws. So this is range one, 5 dice. That's a lot. Wow.
Mm-hmm.
4 strength, 2 5. 4, 4, 18 wounds.
Yeah, 18 wounds is pretty tough. And like you said, 5 dice is a lot. So you are fishing for crits. But the base damage, too, is also not terrible either. So these are really solid little bruisers. You have to kind of compare it to the other build for it, which is the bloated one with the Raker Claw and Hook Net. So rather than two claws, you have one claw and a net. So you lose a dice, but you gain access to a net ability, which we'll talk about in a bit. And net abilities are generally very, very strong in this game.
Yeah, unlocks a rune mark called Trapper.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah. Yeah, I mean, you know, what's really interesting is, you know, I'm looking at the Horns of Ashut, and I'm thinking they have high wounds and high toughness. But so do these guys.
Yeah, there's a lot more 10 wound and 12 wound, it looks like here. It looks like you're... you have a few really tough dudes. I don't know how many bloated ones come in the box, whether it's just one bloated one or two bloated ones, but I think you're getting multiple ruinators. So I'd be interested to see like a total count, like once you add up all the models and all the wounds available to them, to see exactly how much, because yeah, 18 wounds is kind of a big jump compared to 15 wounds, just based on like how many attacks statistically it takes to get to a kill on either one of those.
Mm-hmm.
But then after that, you know, you just have the Witherlord and the bloated ones that are tough. Everybody else is 12 or less. So it'll be interesting to see which one ends up feeling tougher over time.
Yeah, you only get one bloated one.
Oh, so that, yeah, so your Horns of Hishud are going to have more high wound guys, but they don't have the singular high wound count that the bloated one gives you.
Yeah, because you have 20 and 18 versus the Ruinators are 15, right?
Yes, and I believe there's 2 or 3 Ruinators in the box.
Yeah, I mean, I'm looking at the sprue. It's kind of hard to tell, but I think you're right. There's 2, and then there's 1 with the flamethrower. Well, that's not a ruinator. He's a demolisher.
I'm just going to look at this picture real quick.
I think there's 1 ruinator.
Oh, yeah, it does look like there's only 1. So yeah, it might actually be less wounds overall, because there's 3 Shatterers, and there are, it looks like, 4 Mirefolk, which are kind of the smaller ones for these guys, which are 10. So I'm going to guess it averages out to about equal to each other. Yeah. Interesting.
Still cool.
Yeah, for sure. But yeah, the bloated ones, I think both options here are solid. 5 dice is amazing. Nets are also amazing. I think you're gonna pick which version you like the look of the most, and then either one's going to turn out just fine for you.
Yeah, it's just 1 dice difference, really. But then you trade that 1 dice for Trapper. But let's move on.
Mm-hmm.
We've got Carrion Catchers, so you can give them Snatcher Hooks or Impalers. Both are range 2, both are 3 dice, both are 4. The Snatcher Hook is a 2-4 in terms of damage, while the Impaler is a 2-5. But the rest of the stats are quite similar. For the Snatcher Hook, you have 4-4-12 for 110 points. And you have the... What does this look like? You get a new rune mark when you use that one.
I think that's Berserker? I could be wrong. It's like a skull with lightning bolts coming out of the cheeks.
Destroyer,
that's right.
Yeah. Versus an Impaler, where you don't have the Destroyer ability, but you're 5 points more because I think you're spiking into 2-5 damage.
Yes. The destroyer rune mark does unlock the quad, which we'll talk about when we get to the abilities. So again, it's a little bit like some of the other it's a little bit like the bloated one, where it's like the impaler is straight up better, but if you want that ability, you're going to go with the snatcher hook.
Yeah.
So, and then we have Mirefolk, right, which you mentioned earlier, 65 or 75 points depending on their weapon outlook. One of them, the 75 one, is a range 2, whereas the 65 point is a range 1. Pretty similar in stats. You're just trading off dice for damage. Very common Warcry decision making, right?
Yeah, absolutely.
So what are your thoughts overall on the fighters before we get into the abilities?
This feels like a much more... It feels a little bit more rounded, or a little less fully rounded than the Horns of Hishut, because they don't have that that range weapon from the flamethrower. They also don't have like a like we said, kind of those. I feel like their 12 wound models are a little bit less impressive in the attack profile. We may see the abilities turn out a little bit more. So I think that they're going to be reliant a little bit on their Witherlord and bloated ones to kind of do the heavy lifting, and everything else is a little bit weaker in damage. But I do think they get access to more interesting abilities, and we can talk about those next.
Yeah, well, why don't we do that? Let's start with their reaction.
Sure.
So this is called Bile Blood. A fighter can make this reaction when they're targeted by a melee attack. After the damage is totaled, but before it is allocated, roll the dice for each critical hit scored from that attack action. For each 3+, allocate 3 damage points to the fighter that made that attack action.
This is kind of like counter. I think if you compare, which is the universal reaction that you take when you're attacked by a melee attack. So I think you're just going to have to play it by ear in terms of like when you want to use Bile Blood versus when you want to use counter, because counter is better when you are higher toughness than your opponent, because they will miss more and you'll get more counter damage. Bile Blood feels stronger if your opponent has good strength already, so they're going to be missing less. If they have a lot of dice and they're fishing for crits, Bile Blood will obviously have higher chance to deal damage back. If they have any ability like the Horns of Hishut, where you're dealing crits on 5s and 6s instead of just 6s, it's more chances for you to roll Bile Blood. So I think they're pretty similar, and that's good because counter is a good ability, and so being similar to counter is, you know, just also good. But yeah, this is a solid start to their ability section, I think.
Agreed. Agreed. So they've got 3 doubles, 2 triples, and a quad. So let's talk about the first double, Gruesome Harvest. Essentially, a fighter can only use this ability if an enemy fighter has been taken down by a melee attack made by them this activation. This fighter now has a potent vial until the end of the battle. While a fighter has a potent vial, when they use an ability, the value of that ability is treated as being 6. Even if the ability does show a different score.
This is really awesome. And I think this is another example, kind of like Ash Bomb, of them just trying new and interesting things with abilities. It's not just flat damage. It's not just boosting your stats. It's not just, you know, doing kind of just a straightforward thing. This is, okay, am I going to want to be using more abilities? So will I use this? What abilities is this going to affect? And a lot of times it's going to be really strong, and then sometimes it won't be, and it's going to require some forethought as to when and how you use it. But I think it is a really, really, really cool ability, if nothing else.
I completely agree. I think that you can see, I think you'll find creative ways to play this, and, it's going to be very powerful when it works out.
Yeah, for sure.
The next one is another double called Blowpipe. Pick a visible enemy fighter within 6 inches and roll 2 dice. For each 4+, allocate a number of damage points to that fighter equal to half the value of this ability rounding up. In addition, for each 6, subtract 1 from that fighter's toughness characteristic until the end of the battle round to a minimum of 1.
This does have the scout rune mark, so this is your mire folk and your carrion catchers, so your mid to small type sized fighters. This sort of like pseudo ranged attack ability is pretty common in Warcry, and they're usually pretty good, especially because you're always doing half the value of this ability, which again, if you use Gruesome Harvest and you treat it as 6, you're always doing 3 damage off of it. But the -1 toughness is nice because then you could just kind of follow that up and now you're hitting on 3s instead of 4s. So it's almost like a combo piece in a lot of ways.
Yeah, it's really evocative of poison hits you, starts weakening your constitution.
Yes.
Making you more susceptible to further attacks.
Absolutely.
Which I really like. I think this one you're really excited about. This one's called Hooked Net, and this is for trappers. So double, pick a visible enemy within 1 of this fighter and roll the dice. On a 3+, allocate a number of damage points to that fighter equal to the roll, and that fighter cannot make move actions or disengage actions for the rest of the battle round.
And this is why you would take the hook net over the raker claws, is because just turning off movement on a fighter is really, really strong. Like if you get that on the first activation on an important enemy fighter, like you,
or like a monster even.
Yeah. Cause you can hook down monsters. But anything that's like big and expensive that you want to lock down and then kind of pile on, or maybe it's an opponent that's like going to walk onto an objective that you have to hold to win the game. And you're like, psych, you can't move. Now you can't get on the objective and I'm going to go claim it. Like these type of abilities are very, very strong.
Yeah. I like it. I like the ability to CC somebody right effectively, which is pretty cool.
Mm-hmm.
Or in Underworld's term, slap a move token on them.
Absolutely.
Let's jump into our first triple. So this is for brutes, and it says a slashing attack. Roll the dice for each visible enemy fighter within 3 of this fighter. On a 3-4, allocate 1 damage point to the fighter being rolled for. On a 5-6, allocate a number of damage points to this fighter being rolled for equal to the value of this ability.
That is for both of the bloated ones. I mean, yeah, you have a solid little AoE thing. I mean, it's not often that you're going to be surrounded by 2, 3, or 4 models. You have to be doing something very scary to be surrounded by that many dudes at the same time. But I mean, if you run into the middle of a bunch of things, roll a couple 5s and 6s, maybe you have your Gruesome Harvest, so it always counts as 6 damage for the ability value. It's nice, but I think it's going to be less common than some of the single target stuff.
Yeah, I agree. Completely agree. The next triple is called Lethal Injection. Pick a visible enemy fighter within 1 of this fighter and roll a number of dice equal to the value of this ability. For each roll that exceeds the toughness characteristic of that fighter, allocate 5 damage points. So.
And this is only for the leader, but it is hilarious.
Yeah. It's very good, though.
Yeah, I mean, exceeding toughness can be kind of tough because, again, most fighters are 3, 4, or 5, which means at the very least at the very best, it's only going to be 4 pluses. But if you are facing down one of those 10 wound fighters, if it's like a 10 wound tough 3 fighter, all you got to do is roll 2 4 pluses and it just dies.
Just marks them immediately.
Yeah. It's hilarious.
Yeah. Or significantly weakens, you know, a bigger monster or a hero or,
yeah, because it's an ability, you just chunk him for 10 or 15, and then you just punch him immediately afterwards with your good attack. So, yeah, for sure.
It's doable. And then we get to the quad. So the quad is called Ensnaring Strike. This fighter makes a bonus action. In addition, if that attack action scores any critical hits. So you make a bonus attack action. If you get any critical hits, the target fighter cannot make move actions or disengage actions for the rest of the battle round.
Yeah, again, it's a net ability, so turning off moves, and it's a bonus attack. Like we said, quads are usually bonus attacks. This is available to your Witherlord, so your leader, and the carry and catcher with the hook. I mean, you're probably usually going to use this on your leader, run up, do a regular attack, doing a snaring strike attack. Now you're getting, you know, two or even three attacks in a single activation, and you lock the opponent in place. And because you're range two, if your opponent's only 1 inch, they can't even attack back. So it's really powerful. I think it's one of the better ones in the game.
Yeah, I completely agree. I like it. Mm-hmm. And reading these abilities, I am very interested in how they play. I don't think they've swayed me from the horns, but they're more intriguing than I thought they'd be.
It seems that their attacks are weaker, but because you have multiple ways to turn off movements, you have kind of some incidental range damage with like the blow darts and stuff. They're going to be like less straight up kill things and more like, all right, I'm going to debuff you, I'm going to do some incidental damage, and then I'm going to run in and hit you with my weapon.
Exactly, which is on brand, right? Poison your opponents,
yeah,
and then mop them up. Whereas the horns are like kill. I mean, they're just like fire everywhere.
Yeah, and absolutely.
Stab things. So there are, you know, some cool rules for the terrain as well. We're not going to get into the details of those just because it just kind of defines on whether they're scalable or not, and platforms, and whether you can, you know, jump and stuff. And you know, that's really cool. Again, that's an aspect of Warcry that's really fun. But I think that kind of covers the Heart of Gur box set. What do you think, Zach?
Yeah, I think we've gone through everything in here, along with a nice little breakdown of the core rules for anybody new. If you're listening to this, and you know you've made it through all 2 hours of our recording, I hope you have enjoyed it and you really consider getting the new box set. I mean, there's a lot of stuff to love in here. We got two really cool teams. We got a really cool rules update. Yeah, it's great, honestly.
Yeah. My next question was going to say, like, what do you do you think people should buy it? But it sounds like you answered that. And
yeah,
I completely agree. I think, you know, ultimately the miniatures are cool. So if you're a hobbyist and you're interested in just building, converting, painting some beautiful miniatures, this is a great set for you.
And not to mention terrain, because the buildings and the trees and stuff that come in this, it's going to look awesome on this board, but then you can put it on a bigger, you know, Age of Sigmar board or whatever other game you play, and it's going to look just great on there too.
Yeah, even 40K, I mean, you know, there are different kinds of planets in the 41st millennium.
Mm-hmm.
And so you can end up on like a swampy planet with, you know, old school architecture. So completely agree on that as well. In terms of a game, I think Warcry is a lot of fun. I think this new rule set is better, more improved, more balanced. And I think, honestly, like whether you want to play open play, match play, or narrative play, there is a game for you. Now, I don't think for my Underworlds listeners out there that this is going to like scratch the same itch as Underworlds. Underworlds is a very different game, and it can get really sweaty, but I wouldn't sleep on Warcry. I think it can be that game where you can have a lot of fun, roll some dice, and could be a great gateway game to your family members, maybe some children, or some buddies who are on the cusp of maybe joining the hobby. You know, and the hobby can be some, you know, a little expensive at times. So Warcry is really cool in that they can just buy one warband and commit to it and go on that narrative campaign with you and have some fun. So my recommendation is totally to buy it. If anything, just for the plastic alone. The plastic and the sprues, fantastic. And it's made me really excited to paint something which I haven't experienced that in a little bit.
Yeah, I think that's a great point. Like, you know, you can say that it is a bit of an expensive box, or I mean, I assume it's going to be. I don't know what the prices are yet. But they have jumped up in price a little bit over time. But I would say you're still getting a lot of worth out of it. Like, you're getting the rule books, you're getting a board, and then you're just getting a whole heap of plastic. Like, you've got the box in front of you right now, and between terrain and two warbands, and then, like, you know, just the usual dice and tokens and stuff, like, you're getting a whole mess of things, man. It is a lot of stuff for the money.
Yeah, I mean, like, there's, you know, like, I guess it's like a entire sprue, but it can be cut in half. So it's like a page of sprues for each warband. And then, you know, 1, 2, 3, 4, 5, 6 additional full-size sprues for the terrain. It's incredible.
Yeah, it's crazy.
Yep, and then you get the rules and everything. So, again, we think you should check out Warcry. It's a fun game. It's certainly not Underworlds, but it's not supposed to be. That's why it's different. And if you want a way in which you can try the games, wait for additional rules that are supporting the Warhammer Underworlds warbands, who can be played in the Warcry setting as Bladeborn warbands / fighters. Mm. So check that out. But Zach, any comments that you have before we wrap things up?
No, just echo what you said. I think people should at least try it out. I mean, I recommend you pick it up because I think it's going to be a great product and the new edition looks really fun. But if nothing else, find someone who has it, find a store that's got it open, try it out. And if you like it, you know, maybe pick up a warband yourself, maybe pick up the rule book, maybe pick up the box set.
Yeah. I mean, or split it with a friend.
Yeah.
Right.
Can always do
like,
that.
And if you want to, you know, maybe two people can buy the same box and then trade so that they can have the ability to, you know, make all of the fighters for the Rottmeyer Creed or all of the fighters for the Hashut. Or you can split a box, each take a warband, share the terrain, have a good time. I mean, there's so many different ways you can go about it. So people do that for Underworlds, you know, so.
Mm-hmm. For sure.
Can't see why you can't do that for Kill Team and Warcry. So anywho, I think we're going to keep telling you that you should get it. So you should, for many different reasons. But yeah. So that's our first Warcry review. Pretty excited. You know, as I mentioned earlier at the beginning, before the show started, thank you again to Games Workshop for sending us a review copy here at Path to Glory. It was sent by them for free by Games Workshop. And I do have to stress that. You know, we're going to be getting more Kill Team stuff, more Warcry stuff, and as always, every single Underworlds release. So I guess we're coming... getting a lot of skirmish stuff, and we're totally cool with that. So whether it's a podcast or some written document, we'll always be reviewing that and spreading that into the internet. But that's enough from us. We definitely think that you should invest in the Heart of Gur and maybe have some special heartwarming moments while you're murdering each other on the battlefield. So once again, thank you to our Patreon supporters. If you'd like to join our current patrons, you can do so at patreon.com/pathtoglory. You can find all of our blog content on Path to Glory Podcast. And if you have any feedback, questions, or comments, let us know on Facebook, Twitter, or Discord, you know, wherever. Path to Glory Podcast, that's the place. You can also DM me and Zach whenever you feel like it on Discord. Please rate and subscribe to this podcast on any platform that you hear it on. Anytime these algorithms get these 5-star ratings, more people can listen and spread the joy of the hobby. And as always, we really appreciate you listening, so thank you so much. And we wish you the best of luck on your Path to Glory in the Heart of Gur.